Welcome. I'm Angie Coiro. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm in for Rose today. While the world's attention has shifted to the Middle East, the tragedies continue in Ukraine. Now, there's one you may not have heard of. Thousands of Ukrainian children taken from their homes and schools held in Russia or Russian-controlled territory. Now, this has been going on since the invasion in 2022. The new PBS Frontline documentary, Children of Ukraine, follows Ukrainian families searching for their missing children, organizations investigating the alleged abductions, and Ukrainian teenagers who escaped and say they were subjected to Russian propaganda. Ukraine says Russia has taken an estimated 20,000 Ukrainian children into Russian-held territory or into Russia itself. It's calling the mass abductions of children illegal deportations. Now, Russia insists it's part of a humanitarian effort to protect the children. What is Russia's goal, taking all these children away? The International Criminal Court said these are war crimes. It's issued arrest warrants for Vladimir Putin and his Commissioner for Children's Rights. Now, that was in 2023. What is being done at this moment? Paul Kenyon, director and co-producer of Children of Ukraine, joins us. Paul is a multi-award-winning investigative journalist. He's a reporter from war zones around the world, including Ukraine, and he's authored three books, the latest of which is Dictatorland, The Men Who Stole Africa. Children of Ukraine is now available to stream for free on PBS.org Frontline, YouTube, and in the PBS app. Paul, welcome, and thank you for this documentary.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
So the war in Gaza has understandably pulled a lot of people's minds away from what's happening in Ukraine. Russia's been doubling down on its attacks, and in response, the U.S., Germany, the U.K., the EU are shipping more arms, more ammunition. Before we get into the film itself, can you give us a sense of where you think, as a journalist, where you think the war is heading?
You're the first person to ask me that whilst I've been talking about this particular film, but it's a good question. I mean, it's one of those, because I spent a lot of time in Ukraine, I hesitate to say this because it's... It fills me with dread, but it feels to me as though the line that had been static for several months, possibly up until Christmas this year, which was, you'll recall, it was sort of through certain parts of Donbass, but a large section of the east of Ukraine had been taken by Russia. I suspect that line now is beginning to move ever so slightly in Russia's favor. And if it's not the actual line that is moving, it is the intensity of battle and the fact that it's said that Russia has something like 10 times more firepower on the ground in those areas than Ukraine does at the moment. And I've been down some of those fronts, and these are ghost towns, these are ghost cities and ghost villages where very few people can exist. And those few who are left tend to be the elderly, who are very much in need of assistance, people with disabilities who sometimes can't find themselves out or can't find their way out, and sometimes people who are slightly dysfunctional, who have alcohol problems or drug problems and have found themselves remaining in these cities. And sometimes a very small number are just those people who are determined to stay, whatever the threat. But, you know, these are ruined places. And so, in short, when you ask me how it's shaping up so that this year will be decisive, and the rejection by the US of any further aid would very much give a huge advantage to Russia over the coming months.
I appreciate your honesty with that. Ukrainian officials say that we're up to some 20,000 children now abducted by Russia, and these range from toddlers to teenagers. And in the case where you document they're still alive, Russia is essentially taking on the care and feeding and education of all of them. That's something of a burden. So what is their goal? What's their point?
Yeah, it's a good question, isn't it? So for those people who don't realize this is happening, which is most people, we think of the war as I've just described, but those destroyed cities and towns. And actually, this is a different level. It's more subtle. It's very long-lasting. And sometimes the reasoning for it can be quite opaque. But the removal of 19 or 20,000 Ukrainian children and what happens to them after that removal is something that the Ukrainians in that area would say undermines a significant part of a generation of young Ukrainians. And so we know that when they're taken to these Russian camps or put in Russian schools, that what happens to them very quickly is that they're put in Russian uniforms and forced to sing the Russian anthem. And so this is a form of propaganda. And of course, the Ukrainians are very upset and disturbed about it. And they would say that it's there to undermine their national identity, mm-hmm. to do this with a sizable chunk of people from these peripheral villages all down that front and undermine their Ukrainian nationality. So, you know, these may have come from families that speak or used to speak Russian. But since the beginning of the war, most of the people in Ukraine now, as a response to what's happened, will not speak the language of the oppressor, as they call it. They do speak Ukrainian. So these are children taken away from their families and find themselves on the other side of the line. And if you think about it, what's extraordinary is that their fathers sometimes will be fighting the war against Russia with them on the other side, them in potential areas of danger, and the rest of their family trying to defend themselves from Russian artillery.
Some of the takings of the children are excessively violent. Some of them, you talked to us about a particular institution where a number of soldiers walked in and it was essentially nonviolent at the end. They were armed, though. The potential for violence is there. But there's also the case of a very young boy who's taken in a very violent situation. Talk to us about him.
Yeah, this is a little boy called Max, who was 3 years old, just about to turn four, and his family were fleeing Mariupol, and your listeners will remember that was very quickly surrounded by Russian troops at the start of the war. And as his family was leaving, there were six of them all crammed into one vehicle. They were trying to get out through what they hoped was a safe corridor out to Mariupol, and they came under attack, and many occupants of the car were killed. So the little boy's mother and the little boy's grandfather and grandmother, who later died. But one of the survivors was this little boy, Max, and his little brother and sister. Max was he was injured. We don't know to what extent. We think that he was shot in the shoulder, but he was going to be fine. It looked as though he would recover, and he was taken by Ukrainian troops back into Mariupol to the hospital to try and get treatment. And if you think about it, this is right at a key moment when who is actually in control of the city of Mariupol is still swaying backwards and forwards. Nobody quite knows how it's going to go. And at that very moment that he arrived in the hospital, the Russians took over that area of Mariupol. So suddenly he was in Russian hands. And at that point, he disappears. So what we know is this little boy, Max, disappeared once he was in Russian hands sometime just after the start of the war. And so a lot of this program is spent trying to track him down. Where's he gone now? Who took him? And the trail goes cold very quickly. We know that his little brother and sister did survive that the ambush as well. They now live in a safer part of Ukraine, and we spent some time with them and with their auntie, a very young auntie. She's just in her 20s. She's very active trying to find out what happened to little Max. But it's a tragic story, and for a little while, it did really grip the hearts of a lot of people in Ukraine. Whilst the war is raging, they were very concerned because this story became a story that symbolized really what was happening to Ukrainian youth. And when I say youth, I mean a 3 or 4 year old boy. And of course, you will know, and your listeners will know, that one of the problems is that if you take a 3 or 4 year old boy away from his family, and that it's for 2 years now since the start of the war, the likelihood is he'll find it very difficult to remember who his parents are, where he's from, or what his address was. So his aunt will say now, and the aunt's one of the surviving members of the family, she would say, you know, and this is a terrible thing for her to have to say, but she feels as though at least if he's with an adopted family in Russia, he would be safe, and she may be able to get the paperwork one day to try and take him back, because she's just praying he's at least with an adoptive family.
Paul Kenyon is director and co-producer of the PBS documentary Children of Ukraine. You were talking about how young they're being taken, and there's one thing about a young child's mind is it's very malleable. And there's a scene that, it's a cliche, but I have to call it absolutely chilling. It gives you chills to see this huge sports arena, and it's crammed with people waving the Russian flags. And there's a ceremony with a group of children thanking Russia for taking them on. They're showing not just gratitude, but enthusiastic love of their captors with hugs and such. And it does make you wonder, in the cases where the parents can get to those children again, that long, long road that lies ahead of them.
Yeah, when I saw those scenes, it was we were some way actually into investigating these cases anyway, and we'd started making our film. And my researcher in Ukraine said, "Have you seen this this big event in the stadium in Moscow?" Well, I hadn't seen it at that stage, and it is chilling. I mean, it's unbelievable. And so, it's for those who haven't seen it, it's a huge football stadium or sports stadium, absolutely packed with enthusiastic support of Putin. Putin comes on stage to huge cheers, of course, and then there are some soldiers who also come in, and it turns out that these soldiers were some of those in Mariupol around the scenes I've just described, and then a whole load of small children come on. Some of them look to me as though they're 6-7 years of age, and they're encouraged to run over and thank the soldiers and hug the soldiers for saving their lives, as they're told, you know. And this, they don't have any, I mean, they're all smiling, they're relieved, no doubt they've escaped a very dangerous situation, but they don't know who was responsible for that dangerous situation, or who was really responsible for taking them away from that dangerous situation, or what any of the politics are. And there they are on stage, hugging these sort of huge, hefty soldiers. And it's a shocking moment, because of course we'd all stand there in the stadium if we were there, finding it chilling. But of course, the crowd are cheering and saying and shouting "Putin, Putin," and saying, "You know, there's proof, if you like it, that we're saving the youngsters who are traumatized by this war." But of course, it was Russia who started the war. Mm-hmm. So, you know, those about what happens to them after that. I mean, the ones who are on the Russian side, they may well now believe that they were rescued by Russians. But there are some of the children that we feature in our film who managed to get home to Ukraine. A number of them stood up for themselves. They were able to say, "There is no way that I'm going to be singing the anthem. And if that means you put me in solitary confinement in this camp, I'd prefer that. I'm not putting on a Russian uniform." And there's one of them who you may recall, because I think you've seen the film. There's one who's called Vlad, who only recently came back from a Russian-held camp, and he was instructed to go and raise the Russian flag on a flagpole above the camp they were being kept in. And instead of raising the Russian flag that day, he decided that he'd raise a pair of his own underpants. So he strapped his underpants to the flagpole and raised that. And obviously, you know, it's comical, but it's also quite a dangerous thing to do. And he was very quickly picked up and taken into a solitary confinement room. And it was months later he managed to get back to Ukraine. But what I'm saying is that although some of them, understandably, would fully accept the Russian line that they've been saved by Russia, there'll be some who do try and resist.
Mm-hmm. That's such a brave thing to have done. Just incredibly brave. What character.
Mm. So, yeah. He was in the offices when we met him of an organization called Save Ukraine, which is in Kyiv. And they spend all their time, all their resources tracking down missing Ukrainian children in Russian territory, usually by using a lot of intelligence either online or connections that they have on the ground who are sympathetic to their cause on the Russian side. And then they try and organize mothers, very brave mothers and grandmothers, to go out and collect those children. And it's not straightforward, of course. It's not that you just turn up, show some documents, and the Russians sort of tip their hats and say, "Congratulations, here is your son or daughter back." It doesn't happen like that. I mean, the parents who go and try and pick up their own children, once identified, of course, they're taking another huge risk. And, you know, we followed the case of a grandmother who went into Russia all the way through Moscow and then down to Crimea to try and pick up her two grandchildren. She was interrogated by the Russian security services, and she was so traumatized that not very, very long after that, she had a heart attack on the street in Russia and died. And it's tragic. She was just a few hours away from getting to find her two granddaughters. She was that close, but it never happened. In fact, one of those granddaughters has since managed to return to Ukraine, and we did film her for the program. But you know, that again, that level of risk, a young mother, or in this case it was an elderly grandparent, deciding they were going to take that risk to go and find their children. And of course, you know, you mentioned at the beginning, you're absolutely right, the Russians will say, what we're doing is we're saving these children and we're protecting them from the front line. So we're removing them from schools, orphanages, wherever we found them when our troops swept in early at the start of the war, and we have removed them back away from the front to points of safety. And superficially, you might say, well, that sounds as though that might be a thing they could do. But then you have to ask the question why 2 years later, some of those children are still there. And the Russians know it's extraordinarily difficult for Ukrainian families to get across the border to go and pick up their children, to enter a country that they are fighting against and go there and try and pick up their children. It's just a very, very difficult thing to do.
And there are some bits of this that feel very 1984-ish. There's Putin saying, well, there's no time for formalities. We're rescuing these children to their new life in Russia. And he's talking to his commissioner for children's rights, and they're both warm and so concerned about the children, as she's said to have adopted some of her own. And it's just, you just wonder how that can happen.
And Maria Lvova-Belova. And yeah, it is. It's an extraordinary thing. And those, I mean, but both of them, there's an arrest warrant that was issued by the International Criminal Court in March 2023 for both Putin and this woman that you mentioned there, Maria Lvova-Belova. And the allegation is criminal responsibility for unlawful deportation and transfer of children from occupied areas of Ukraine to Russia. And that, taking them or transferring them, deporting them, however you want to call it, with an intent to destroy a national or ethnic group, that is a war crime. And that's what the International Criminal Courts want to put Putin on trial for. So, yeah, I mean, that scene where we see Putin sitting there chatting with with Maria Lvova-Belova, and him saying, yeah, let's dispense with these formalities. Well, you know, his dispensing with formalities means to him, we'll pick them up very quickly and bring them back into Russia. But that is also, of course, just a euphemism for there will be that we take who we want and we explain ourselves later, if at all. So those that arrest warrant, you know, it's been in place now for more than a year. But realistically, the idea that they're going to get either Putin or Maria Lvova-Belova in front of a court in The Hague seems pretty remote. I mean, you'd have to go to a hostile country, and he's not realistically going to do that.
Right, right. So it's pro forma as opposed to actually accomplishing anything.
Yeah.
So you do follow a brave young team with the International Partnership for Human Rights, and they work to find the missing kids. First, tell us who that group is, and then talk about what they are actually doing to work on finding the children.
Yeah, so the International Partnership for Human Rights, the IPHR, it was an organization I hadn't come across before we started making this program. And one of my colleagues said, you know, we probably do need to spend some time with one of the investigating agencies. And there's a few on the ground there. Most of them are very closely connected to the Ukrainian government. And the Ukrainian government, for obvious reasons, wants to keep this not quiet, but they don't want to show you the details of how they go about doing this, because they don't want the Russians to find out how much they know. So the IPHR were, they've got a headquarters outside Ukraine. So they do other human rights stuff all over Europe. But as I say, first time I came across them, and we went round to see them. And to me, they look extremely young. I mean, they're all in their mid-20s. And there were three of them in who agreed that we could follow them around. So they sit there in their apartment in Kyiv, and they plot a course of where they're going to go to investigate the various cases of missing and deported children. Now, if you think about it, the only places this has happened are the places that Russia used to control. So Russia took and occupied at the start of the war, and that since then the Ukrainians have pushed the Russians back. So these are occupied areas. So of necessity, everywhere they go is going to be right along the front. So it's a dangerous journey they take week in, week out. So we went with them, and their purpose really is to go and interview parents whose children have gone missing, and institutions like orphanages where many children have gone missing, and sometimes to actually interview children who've been retrieved, to just put together a picture and to get evidence that they can then put in front of the International Criminal Court, which will help with the prosecution of Putin. So, we spent some time with this group and traveled down along the battlefront in the east of Ukraine with them. And they were a brave bunch, and it was great to see them at work. I mean, they take their job so seriously, and they behave like lawyers, of course, because they needed to make sure everything they got was not partial at all, that it was backed up by evidence, and they had clearly written documentation and evidence to support whatever stories they found whilst they were out there. Mm-hmm. So we went with them to Kherson, which is South Ukraine. And if you envisage the map of Ukraine, it's sort of in the southeast corner, and it's not far from Crimea. And this is a place that was taken by the Russians quite early on in the war, and then the Ukrainians pushed them back out of there. And actually, half of Kherson is still occupied by the Russians. So when we went into the city of Kherson to go and see the IPHR do some of their interviews, there were constant explosions in the background because the Russians were just on the other side of the river. So they lob over artillery throughout the day. And the extraordinary thing is that the girl that the IPHR had gone to meet there, who had been kidnapped by the Russians and then brought back to Ukraine by an organization, she lived, I would say, two or three kilometers from the front. Mm-hmm. And whilst we spoke with her in the garden of her parents' home, constant shelling in the background, she didn't even notice it. It was one of those things that she was sort of shell deaf, if you like. That particular concern and fear that we would all have had abated so long ago that she didn't even really hear it. She wasn't conscious of it. And when the IPHR team said, the shelling's getting too close, we need to go to a safer place, she became absolutely furious and started running around saying, how dare you tell me what to do? There's a lot of swearing because she's quite a traumatized girl. But she was saying, how dare you? I live here. I live like this all the time. You're all a bunch of cowards. Right. That was her response.
Well, for the children who are so scarred by their experiences, you interview one boy who's just heartbreaking. His face is absolutely stone throughout. In this war-torn country, are there any systems in place that can help them? Do they have access to counseling? Do they have any safety net?
Yeah, there is some counseling. It's one of those things, of course, that because they're still at war and because these children are from that particular front down in the east of Ukraine, they're not. It's something that won't seem to be a priority to them. And so, the priority to them is to keep pushing the Russians further and further back and get them out of Ukraine. And so, that obviously being the priority of the country. And so, although there are some organizations that do go and offer their support, normally what happens is for any kind of counseling, they would need to get the child out of that high risk, that hot zone, if you like, and take them to the west of Ukraine. That does happen on occasions. But also, a lot of these children sadly come from quite dysfunctional backgrounds. Some of them were in orphanages or boarding schools when the war started. All their parents have been killed in the war. You know, a father easily could have been killed in the war from those areas. So have they got counseling? They do have, but I think it's something that will happen. And let's pray that when the war does finish and that some of these children will be in a position where, you know, for the rest of their lives or to be allowed to embark on the rest of their lives, they can begin to get some kind of counseling in the west of Ukraine. It's a strange thing, actually. When you asked me that, I had to think quite quickly because right near the beginning when we were making this film, a number of people said, do you want to go and see some of the agencies who offer counseling? And some of them are kind of religious run Christian Orthodox organizations in Poland and in the west of Ukraine. And at the beginning, it sounded like a good idea. And then we thought, we're so far away, really, from the sort of the hot zone, but B, the sort of raw stories, the raw authentic stories we needed were always going to be near to the battlefront. And so those organizations, as I said, Christian Orthodox organizations, they would, these are usually children who have, whose parents are pretty well to do or at least so well informed that they would know that they exist in the first place. Mm. It's a terrible thing, isn't it? Because both in the US and the UK, any child who'd been through just a small percentage of that kind of trauma would very quickly be put into some kind of therapy and counselling. And it's just obviously not possible at the moment on any scale in Ukraine.
Paul Kenyon, this is just such an important documentary. Thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you.
Paul Kenyon is director and co-producer of Children of Ukraine. He's also a journalist internationally. If you'd like to see the documentary, it's available now on YouTube. You can go to pbs.org/frontline, or you can use the PBS app. We're going to take a break here. When we come back, Cal Matters' new investigation. We'll talk to Lauren Hepler. She's author of its article, Meth, Death, and Abuse Inside the Private Security Forces Patrolling California's Homeless. I am Angie Coiro, and I'm sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call.